Matthew Thomas Reed, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. I want to talk a little bit about how you came to be represented in this collection, which is called Storytelling in Queer Appalachia, Imagining and Writing the Unspeakable Other.
Thank you for the question. And, you know, sometimes answers like this are really glamorous and interesting. This one is a little less interesting, but as sometimes happens in, you know, in the academic world, someone says, oh, this sounds like something you'd be interested in. So I immediately read it and I thought, yes, this is fantastic. I hadn't at the time written anything with that sort of intersection of my Appalachian roots. And I kept gravitating to the phonetic pronunciation of queer in the sort of Southern choir. And I kept gravitating to it because I remembered that being a word that was used in some really interesting, non-specifically queer ways, but also some specifically queer ways growing up. So I started thinking through that. And then I knew that I wanted to collaborate with some of my undergraduate students and the writing of the piece. I wanted to sort of do some triangulation with it. And we put together a little abstract and sent it out to the folks who were putting the collection together. And they were really intrigued by the idea of doing some collaborative work with some younger folks, some undergraduate students. So that was something I think that really drew them to want to include it in the collection.
You touched on this dialect a little bit between queer and choir. Can you go into a little bit more depth about that distinction between queer and choir and what those two words represent in a place like Boone?
Yes. It's something I grew up with, and I knew it as kind of this humorous thing. I mean, as a child, devoid really of sexual expression, you know, generally, seven, eight, nine, 10 years old, older folks would look at me and say, "Boy, you're queer," and I got that my whole life. And you know, there are a number of interesting intersectionalities growing up in the sort of the rural foothills of the Appalachians, being both queer, neuroatypical. I stood out in a lot of ways as a child, but that moniker queer, it was always said with some kindness. It was always said with some empathy. It was always said with some community. It was the person that you could kind of humorously smile and rib a little bit, but if anyone else said anything bad, they were in trouble, right? It was that there was something very familial about the idea of queer. And you know, and as I reflect on other stories that didn't get in that piece, I remember two older men, and this is probably when I was 12 years old, and they would come to the barn dances. We would on Friday nights in a place called Windsor's Crossroads, we would get together and people would bring their instruments and there would be little groups of musicians playing. And these two older men would come, I mean, and I say older, they were certainly in their 60s at the time. And they sat together and often they would hold hands. And I remember asking questions, my 8 or 9 year old self, what are they doing? You know, but what I would get, I wouldn't get, you know, anything, oh, stay away from them, or they're there, so they're just choir. But there was something safe about the word, and there was something safe about the association, but it would depend on who you talked to. My father was always like, well, they're good guys, they're friends, they're just, you know, they're, or, you know, they just do what they do, but they're great people, I knew him, you know, I sold him a car 10 years ago, or something like that. But then you'd hear other people say, "Oh, I don't know what's going on with those two," you know. But queer was something. It was odd. It was eccentric. It was different. It might be a little. There might be something going on there, but you were still family, or you were still community, and so there wasn't that. There wasn't the hard-edged other in the word queer.
When did you learn that distinction between queer and what it meant to be queer?
So it was an actual conversation with my father, and we were in the car, and my mother, who is from Burlington, North Carolina, which is still, I mean, very Southern, but also not, you know, you know, she was a Flatlander, right? But we were having this conversation and he would say choir and she'd say, Buddy, don't say that. My father's name was Buddy. And she said, Buddy, don't say that. That's not a good word. And he said, now choir's just fine. It's just fine. And he said, yeah, choir just means that, you know, you just a little bit different. It's just a little bit different. But now he ain't queer. And the voice changed. Again, I was maybe, you know, I was probably still pre-puberty at this point. I was maybe 10, 11, 12 years old. And I heard that edge in the voice change. And I also heard, growing up, these same people who would appreciate the choir would, you know, would make inappropriate gay jokes. These same folks would say, you know, I'd disown a family member if they were gay. And then, of course, there was the shadow of my Uncle Ricky, who I write about in the piece, who died in the mid-1990s, of circumstances that the family deemed as mysterious, that they didn't want to talk about the fact that he, in fact, died of AIDS. And so that specter sat in the background, wasn't talked about, because the hard-edged word queer, it didn't just mean something that was wrong or bad or against the Bible. It meant something that would kill you.
Your piece sort of sets up a dynamic where you've got Ricky, who essentially had to leave to express himself. You talk a little bit about his life in Charlotte and kind of tracking down some of the relationships that he had with people and friends and the community there, which is great. I love that little vignette of what life was like for him and the spaces that he fit into in a city like Charlotte. And then you've got your older uncle who fit more into this choir space and this tolerated space, and that those seem to be the two dynamics that you have if you're from a small town in rural South or rural Appalachia, that those are your two choices. Do you think that that dynamic still exists? And if not, you know, how do you think it's changed where we are today?
Oh, I think we're disrupting it. And I'm very excited. I happen to now live in another very, very small town, not too far from where I grew up. And I do see those same sort of archetypes, the queer, you know, man who's good to his mama. And I see these people all the time and I clock them and not in rude ways, not in, oh, I bet you're whatever, but I clock them and I go, okay, so this is, I'm not going to put a value on this, because sometimes they get married. These individuals have gotten married. Sometimes they've not gotten married. Sometimes, you know, and so that still exists. And there's still the, you know, the young folks who are, you know, as soon as high school's done, they're out. But then I really am noticing folks who are either doing one of two things: they're staying and claiming their identity, or they're coming back. And this was, as a part of my story, I could not wait to get out. I wound up living in England for 5 years. And when I finally came back, I felt like, well, this is a very short period of time. I had broke up with my partner 5 years. And so I needed to come home for a minute, but then I was going to leave again. But then I didn't leave. And I still haven't left, really, the region. And I think that there's a real power in reclaiming the queer in your hometown, in your home area. And I've noticed this with my own story, but also some of my colleagues, some of the hometown queer folks who've stayed and who have asserted who they are and who are proud about who they are, they have some capital. They have some real cultural capital that they can use. And I remember when I first started teaching, I was teaching in my hometown, and folks knew I was gay, but I was also Ellen's boy. my mom had been the secretary at the high school for 20 years. Everyone knew me. I had some capital. People saw me in town. They saw me singing in the Presbyterian choir. While I was very open in my identity, there was a new space that sort of opened up. It was like, well, we know, you know, we, you know, I sort of problematize how they might have viewed me. Maybe they thought I was one of the good ones. You know, there's lots of ways there's lots of ways to problematize those relationships. But I did get one thing consistently throughout my career in K-12, and that was, you're one of the first openly gay people we've met, one of the first openly gay teachers we've met. I had a number of students who came out to me, you know, across that time saying, you know, just knowing your life helped. And and living up here, my husband teaches at the local high school, and also that there are a couple of other folks at the local high school that are out that are providing those same kinds of role models and those same kinds of disruptions. And sometimes the disruptions aren't pleasant. This isn't always good. You know, folks, there's still a great deal of homophobia. There's still epithets being shouted in hallways, and administrations who are still scared to deal with it. But I think that there really has been some significant changes. I'm seeing GSAs popping up, gay straight alliances popping up in schools that I never would have dreamed would have had gay straight alliances. And, you know, I think this is largely due to some of the folks who are breaking and disrupting that tradition. They're coming back and they're still being who they are. And I really think that listening to the voices of, you know, the queer diaspora, I don't know if I'm using that right, but listening to the voices of queer folks who are living in rural areas, I mean, there is some real value, because a lot of us don't have the luxuries of sitting in bubbles and, you know, and just curating a set of friends that are always going to understand pronouns and that are always going to and they're never going to make inappropriate jokes. And that, you know, I've been very fortunate at the university. I have curated mostly that set of friends, but then back out in the hollers, I go, okay, I have to still be able to dialogue. I do have choices. I can just say F you and isolate myself, or I can try to make inroads into the community. And I think there's actually something pretty radical about that.
What do you think it means to your students, to younger folks in general, to see a collection of stories like this coming from a place like West Virginia?
That's an excellent question. And I'll think about it. I'm going to think about it in two ways. And the first way, when I teach about diversity and inclusion, I think about is safety for engagement by an understanding of, those are three lenses that I like to use. And so if I think about this collection in terms of engagement by, I remember when I was a boy, I loved libraries, I loved bookstores, but I loved them because I was actually searching. I was searching for representation. And often didn't find it. I mean, yeah, there were a few pieces out there. There was that. There's a seminal text on, you know, growing up gay in the South that came out in the 90s. I think Sears did that one. But it was the stories weren't the stories didn't really end very well. It was, I remember whatever stories I encountered. And part probably why for a while I just steered clear of gay films and gay stories, because they're like, okay, who's going to die in it? And that's a really terrible thing to say, but as someone who, you know, grew up in the, you know, 80s and 90s with that sort of the looming of AIDS hanging over me, I figured whatever stories were out there, they were probably not going to be happy ones. But so I think about engagement by young queer folks now, and I think that there are these options to read about stories like them that are real, but that also can be uplifting. They don't all have horrible endings. And I think there's an important value to be able to see yourself included and to be able to see stories that look like yours and to empathize, because, you know, we know that the ability to, the ability to transfer and the ability to see yourself in other work, you know, that increases engagement. So I think there's a value there, but I think there's a secondary value. And when you get to that piece, understanding of, and that's what, you know, the vast majority of the students I teach, because I'm in a college of education, and I teach pre-service and in-service teachers and future administrators. And the majority of the folks that I teach are straight, they're cis, they're majority white. And some of them still, many of them, I think, still have this idea, particularly those who are going into elementary education, they have this idea, well, these are not things I need to talk about or think about. You know, I'm never gonna, I'm just gonna teach the kids because I love them, and I'm just gonna treat them all the same, and you know, that all of that kind of very sweet sounding language. But I think collections like these and narratives like these, you know, disrupt the idea that you can go in, you know. Yes, even that little rural elementary school back where you grew up, you're going to find queerness there. You know, whether you're working with families, whether you're working with queer families, whether you're working with students, with a variety of gender expressions, it's going to be there. I call these things the queer moments that you sort of can't get away from. And even if you it's not that you should want to get away from them, but one of the things I try to do with my students is teach them to be ready and how will you respond in these moments? How will you work in these situations? And you need to be able to say some of these words out loud, and you need to be able to think some of these ideas out loud. So I think that there's a value not just in engagement by the other, I mean, engagement by LGBTQ us folks, and understanding that whatever context you are, it doesn't matter how rural, it doesn't matter where you're at, you're gonna be working with some folks who are gonna be different than you, and what will it look like for you to interact in that way?
We're in a moment now of another cycle of change and upheaval, and we've made a lot of inroads where it comes to inclusion and diversity, and a lot of understanding has happened. But what's come with it is that you've seen a lot of attacks, physical, legislative, a lot of reaction. Are you seeing that dynamic? How do you deal with the concept that we need to make this change, but we're going to see some opposition?
So to return to one of the lenses of the book, see, I think that's why choir is a tool of power. And I think that it's been a subtle tool of power that has been used, because as long as you're just choir, as long as you sort of know your place, as long as you sort of stay in a particular lane, folks will stay in their lanes. And as soon as you speak the queer, you'll find that as soon as you become explicit in your activism, in your openness, others will become explicit in their opposition. And I think the answer is absolutely yes. So, I mean, obviously, I think some of this has to do with political rhetoric. You know, the Southern Poverty Law Center put out a piece called 10 Days Later, which talked about the sheer number of hate crimes in the 10 days after President Trump was elected. And this is not an attempt to bash a person. This is just saying that words matter. And I think that folks are feeling permission to speak out their homophobia. They're also their racism and their sexism. But I think that there's permission to speak out homophobia in ways that they haven't used to. At 40 years old, I've experienced more incidents of overt homophobia in the last 2 years than I had for the first 38 of my life. And I think that's absolutely a action to visibility, because if we're going to stand and be visible, those who are in opposition now have to stand and be visible. And that provides opportunities for dialogue, and this is the optimistic side of me, because as soon as I know where you stand, I can, you know, I know where to stand in relation to you. But it also provides opportunities for violence, and that's, you know, that's the sort of realist in me, and that's the part of me that's more, I'm more scared now. I took place in a Black Lives Matter march 2 weeks ago here in the small little Appalachian town that I live in. And I have not in my 40 years of life felt more afraid than I did that day, walking down with two queer friends, my friend of color, and walking, you know, wearing our Black Lives Matter t-shirts, walking through downtown as I saw people sitting in vehicles with guns, ready for us to start rioting. You know, I saw people staring stony face. I saw a lot of proud, deplorable t-shirts, you know, a lot of rebel flags. I saw a lot of real stony faced hatred on a lot of faces. And I've lived in the South most of my life. And it's the first time I've really started seeing that. And you know, and I'm actually at a place now where I feel I'm concerned. I've never looked for homophobia. I've never assumed homophobia. I've never assumed, oh, someone's treating me this way because of my sexuality. It's never been a default position. I've had some privilege in not having to do that. Like I said, I was, you know, I was Ellen's boy. I was known in my community. But up here, I find myself after interactions going, wait, was I treated that way for a reason? And it's really getting in. It's starting to get in. It can get in your head, you know, that. And but it feels distinctly different. And I think that it's continuing to happen. I was at a Democratic Party meeting a few days ago when a high school student who incidentally my husband taught leaned out the car and screamed as loud as she could, F Democrats, like four times. And I just don't think that these are things that we've been seeing. You know, so I think there was resistance. I hate to use the word resistance in that way, but I think there's definitely some pushback. So,
what advice would you have to people who are counseling young people of all kinds in this moment?
That's a very difficult question, I think, to answer and to think about. I'm going to take it from my perspective as an educator and thinking about. You know, talking about student, you know, as teachers talking to students. I've always sort of taken the stance that when counseling students about coming out, that your safety is actually more important than you're feeling like you're doing the right thing by coming out. And I know that this sounds counterintuitive. I'm an activist, and I'm very out, and I believe in that. I also have a lot of privilege that allows me to be out in many ways. I'm also white. I'm also cisgender, Southern male. And engaging is fantastic, but I think we're putting a major premium on engagement right now. Oh, well, you've got to be calling out your family members. You've got to be engaging with people on Facebook. You've got to be changing ideas. You've got to be standing up to folks. You've got to be doing this. And yes, the answer is absolutely yes. But the answer is also, and I've started seeing this in the last, you know, few weeks and months with my friends and I doing activism work, some of us are putting our bodies in danger, and we're putting our bodies on the line, and some of our bodies are more vulnerable than others. And, you know, particularly when I'm talking to, you know, young, you know, queer, trans, gender nonconforming folks, especially folks who have, other intersectionalities, queer folks of color, certain bodies are more vulnerable than others. And I have to say, those of us who have the space to speak and to interact and to do this work, yes, step up and do that work. But recognizing that we can't make this call of arms be putting people in physical danger. And recognizing that protecting our young folks, and I have, you know, I've cautioned folks over the years about things like coming out, about, say, you know, I want to stand up to my family, and I've also worked with some of these same students when they've been kicked out of their houses, when they, you know, and trying to help them, you know, when they're food and housing insecure. So I know that this is not exactly an answer to your question, but I think find the spaces where you can affect positive change, but let's not make, especially young folks who are so on fire to do activism, let's make sure that we're counseling them to keep themselves safe and look after themselves, because this is not something that's going to end next week, next month, or next year. I think that we're in this moment for a really long time, and there's activism fatigue. And I know I'm already sort of feeling it in many ways, and a lot of my friends and colleagues and a lot of young people are. So self-care and making sure that, yes, we want to speak truth to power, but sometimes speaking truth to power is met with violence, and recognizing that, you know, putting our young people in places of danger, you know, that's, you know, we have to be very intentional and in our direct action.
Well, Matthew Thomas Reed, thank you so much for taking the time and talking about your piece, which is included in the compilation Storytelling in Queer Appalachia, Imagining and Writing the Unspeakable Other. Best of luck with the release of the collection. Thanks very much.
Fantastic. Thank you so very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.